Anytime there was someone in the cabinet who raised their hand and said, hey, wait a minute, we might want to warn the public, he either fired them or silenced them. There was a moment when Alex Azar simply wanted to add the phrase, but things might change rapidly, to an otherwise very sunny report. He was going to do that on Fox and Friends. When the White House communications team saw that phrase, she pulled him from Fox and Friends and forbade the Department of Health and Human Services from talking to the public or the press for 45 days.
That's Andy Slavitt, a former top healthcare official in both the Obama and Biden administrations. He's just written a new book about how the U.S. failed in its response to the pandemic and why he says it was totally preventable. More on that in a moment. First, let's get the latest on what's new at the box office this weekend with William Bibbiani, film critic and co-host of the podcasts Canceled Too Soon and Critically Acclaimed. Welcome back, Bibbs.
Hello.
Hello. Also here, Jacqueline Coley, editor for Rotten Tomatoes and co-host of the podcast Rotten Tomatoes Is Wrong. Welcome back, Jacqueline.
Bonjour, Madeline. Glad to be back.
Oh, bonjour, because you're at Cannes. You're fancy like that.
A little bit. Having fun.
Okay, well, let's start with something that's not too fancy. It's a horror film. It's called Fear Street Part 2, 1978. That's the title. It's the second installment of a new Netflix series based on R.L. Stine's YA novels. The first came out last week, and each installment focuses on the fictional town of Shadyside. And here's a bit from the trailer.
Hello?
It's not over.
How do we end this?
You have to go back
to 1978. The first day of camp.
One way or another, you're gonna die tonight.
There it is. It's not just a diary, it's a map.
My sister's still out there.
We can end this.
All right, Jacqueline, what's going on here with these three parts? And do we need to watch all three to have it make sense?
No, you definitely don't need to watch all three installments, although I would say that you should because both of them are incredible. This latest installment lives in that late 1970s slasher, you know, away at camp, sort of, you know, sex is the symbol of you're going to die next. Everything that Jamie Kennedy warmed about in Scream is in this one. And it stars Sadie Sink, who folks will recognize from Stranger Things, and Emily Rudd, who are a pair of sisters away at camp when the slashing that has been cursing the town that they live in sort of kicks off again. And I have to say, it is a fun time. If you're a horror movie sort of person that's even a casual viewer, I would say this is still going to be a fun one for you with lots of gore, lots of sex, lots of blood.
Ooh, okay, great. So Bibbs, you too, did you like it?
Oh yeah, I am deeply in love with this trilogy already. We have one more to go. That premieres next week. The first installment was a really wonderful re-encapsulation of the whole ironic 1990s horror boom. And this one just proves that director Lee Janiak, who's doing all installments of this, can kind of do anything. Because this is, if this had come out in the late 1970s, early 80s, and that the burning Friday the 13th era of slasher movies, this would be a classic. This would be beloved. This would have had 80 different Blu-ray releases right by now. The characters are wonderful. The suspense is great. And the way that it's all tying together as one large narrative, each installment kind of stand on its own, but the more you pay attention, the more the details add up, is really impressing me. And I'm really hoping they can stick the landing, because if the next one is even mostly as good as the last two, we're witnessing the birth, I think, of a new horror classic.
Really? Amazing.
Absolutely. Yeah. It really is that good. And what William said about tying it together is the key part. It's so well done.
And you can see the Fear Street series on Netflix. The final installment comes out next Friday. Moving on to another horror film. This one is called Son, and it's about a mother and her young son who falls suddenly ill after a strange group of people attempts to kidnap him. And here's a bit from the trailer.
The doctors couldn't find anything physically wrong with your son.
Think you could have been dreaming?
Wake up, honey.
Why do you think these people were here? Who are they?
I was raised in a cult. It was them.
They're coming for us.
They awakened something in him.
Okay, Bibbs, is this a classic horror film in your estimation?
that might be a stretch, but it is really creepy, and I gotta give it a lot of credit. This is a premise that has been kind of done before, the Rosemary's Baby kind of vibe, where, oh, is my child sort of the locus for supernatural forces? Are creepy people after my kid? Am I somehow the victim of a weird satanic cult? And I think what really grounds it is, A, the leading performance by Andy Matichak, who is probably best known for playing Jamie Lee Curtis's granddaughter in the new Halloween movies. She is just absolutely committed and believable in this role. But I also think that the direction by Ivan Kavanaugh is really, really effective at luring you into this sort of quiet dread and then just completely pulling the rug out from you and showing you something impossibly gory or even subtly terrifying. And I got really wrapped up in this. I don't think this is necessarily the greatest example of this genre, but I think it's a very well-told film. And I, you know, I watch a lot of horror movies. This one's scary. I actually thought it was genuinely creepy. I highly recommend it.
Kind of looked like The Omen in the trailer.
Sure.
Creepy kid. Satanic, creepy kid. Jacqueline, what did you think?
I have to agree. In fact, I would say that before this film sort of reached its sort of climax, the last 5 minutes, I was feeling it was a bit pedestrian. I mean, we've got the occult, we've got a woman being gaslit, we've got the creepy kid and, you know, trying to figure out the mystery of what's happening. But I will say this film goes at a place in the final act that I just did not sort of see initially, and it really, I think, adds an entire new layer to the narrative. If you like those films that make you want to go back and watch it over again the minute you sort of see the credits roll, this one I found really hit for that for me, and really sort of raised it in my estimation because of it.
Okay, that's Sun. It's out now on Shudder. Next up, the big summer blockbuster, Black Widow, the latest from the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It stars Scarlett Johansson and Florence Pugh as two deadly sisters, and here's a bit from the trailer.
I heard you had to leave in a hurry.
It's never easy these days.
So what are you going to do?
I've lived a lot of lives, but I'm done running from my past.
I know you're out there.
I know you know I'm out here. So are we gonna talk like grown-ups?
Is that what we are?
It's good to see you too, sis.
Okay, so reunited, and it doesn't feel so good. Jacqueline, first of all, why does one have a Russian accent and the other doesn't?
Actually, what's really interesting is because they've sort of set these girls up as siblings, but they're actually not. The story of Black Widow has this sort of pseudo family being led by David Harbour, who's this superhero called the Red Guardian, who was fighting on the sort of evil side. And Rachel Weisz plays the mother figure, and then Natasha and Yelena are the two siblings that are put together for this 1 3-year mission. And so this is the only family that Natasha has, but it was while she was actually a spy. So these two sort of live separate lives, and after the events of that first mission that brought them together, we learn that the Red Room, the group that controls the Black Widows, have actually enhanced their mind control. And Natasha, who thought she dismantled them, has to go on the hunt to sort of find the person in charge and in this new mind control that apparently Yelena's been under for the better part of 2 decades. So it's sort of a Black Widow tying up some loose ends from her past, but still really funny. And Florence Pugh is at the center of this, is probably one of the most enjoyments I've had in an MCU character since maybe Loki. She is absolutely hilarious, very self-referential. And you can tell that they're probably going to be setting her up for more stories in the MCU after this one. But Scarlett's great, David's great, Rachel's great, but Florence gets the flowers.
Bibbs?
I like this one a lot. I think... we just had like the biggest Marvel movie like ever, like before the pandemic hit. And this one, you know, the stakes are a little bit lower. You know, it's not the whole fate of the universe. But what really makes it work is that cast. I think if you had removed all of the Marvel elements and just made this a spy story about Johansson, Pugh, Harbour, and Weisz had to pretend to be a family for a few years, and now they're getting back together, and all of that old baggage is in the way, you'd still have a really great spy movie. And I really, really dug that a lot. It's kind of nice to see a Marvel movie that is about the characters and their interactions a bit more than it is about what'll happen with this new space rock that has magic powers. So I dug it a lot. I think it's a very entertaining Marvel answer to the James Bond series, and I had a really good time.
All right, Black Widow is in theater, so you can escape the heat there. Finally, our last film of the day is called Summertime. It's from director Carlos Lopez Estrada. He also did Blindspotting, which I loved. Summertime uses spoken word poetry to take viewers through a hot summer day in Los Angeles. And here's a bit from the trailer.
Have you forgotten where we are? What kind of crazy, dope magic happens in this city? Every day?
Why are you here?
Because this city needs me.
There's literally a street that has stars in it with people's names.
Maybe we're not even depressed. Maybe we just hungry.
All right, Bibbs, you saw this one. And, well, yep. It is summertime in L.A., so perhaps appropriate to watch a movie called Summertime. What did you think?
I really love this movie a lot. You know, I grew up in Los Angeles. I love movies that are about Los Angeles, whether they get everything wrong, which is most of them, or occasionally they get things right. And I think Summertime is one of the films that gets Los Angeles right. It's somewhat a romantic portrayal of the city. It's taking place all over the city over the course of one day. There's about two dozen characters, and they're mostly played by people who are actually like spoken word poets, and they are conveying most of their scenes in poetry that these actors and characters wrote themselves. And yet what they are talking about are situations that are universal while also very much being very specific to the Los Angeles experience, talking about the geography of it, the weird melting pot that we've got in this city, various class struggles, the idea that you can suddenly make it and achieve stardom. There's this hilarious ongoing subplot with like this one rap duo who at the beginning of the day are nobody, and by the end they're so famous that they're bored with it. Like, it's really very, 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 very funny stuff. The cast is wonderful. It just feels like this absolute wonderful encapsulation of the Los Angeles spirit. And I know how I know that sounds like hyperbole. I know that sounds very fanciful. But, you know, I grew up here and this movie really connected to me. And I really did feel like before the pandemic hit, this was kind of what it was like, where just everyone was outside and spilling over on top of each other, and ideas and thoughts and anxieties were just constantly clashing and creating something kind of grander than any one person could have experienced on their own. Wow. So I highly recommend this movie. This is one of my favorites of the year so far. I really hope people see it. I think this is a great summer movie, and I think it's one of my favorite Los Angeles movies.
Okay, wow. Summertime, go see it out in theaters. That sounds wonderful. Jacqueline, you have been busy in another beautiful place, and that is Cannes in the south of France. So I know the big movie that everyone's talking about is Annette.
Yeah.
Why is this movie getting so much buzz?
Well, one, Leo Carax, who's the director of it, is known for being this sort of like avant-garde and visual director. And having Adam Driver in the first musical after we got a tease of it in Marriage Story, the fact that he has some pretty good singing ability, I think is interesting. And it's actually, I will say, visually stunning. It is one of those films that you'll be thinking about images from it long after you see it. And some of the songs, especially the opener, Now May We Start, really are an earworm. And I think they're going to be something in the conversation for best song, but this one's out there. I'll say that this is not commercial instance, so go in with your eyes open, I will say.
And that's out on Amazon, right? Or will be?
Yeah, it'll be out on Amazon, I think, later this summer. And again, I do think it does have some award seasons play, but I think it's going to be interesting when audiences take a peek at it. The trailer is quite deceptive, I'll just say that.
Okay, so a buzzy movie to look forward to perhaps at the end of the summer. All right. Speaking of summer, thank you both so much for coming on today. It was great having you.
Great to be here.
Thank you so much.
Jacqueline Coley is editor for Rotten Tomatoes and co-host of the podcast Rotten Tomatoes is Wrong. And William Bibbiani is a film critic and co-host of the podcast Canceled Too Soon and critically acclaimed. Coming up, former COVID advisor for President Biden, Andy Slavitt. He's written a new book on how the Trump White House chose politics over saving lives during the pandemic.
All I can say is for anybody who doesn't like Deborah Birx, they hadn't had the pleasure yet of meeting Scott Atlas, who was really a Frankenstein monster that filled an opinion that Trump wanted someone to have.
Andy Slavitt, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. COVID is slowly but surely ticking up here in Southern California. LA County says the average daily case rate has doubled in just the past week. So has the test positivity rate. And that's because of the highly contagious Delta variant. Unvaccinated people are the ones affected. There are currently 4 million LA County residents not yet vaccinated. We're going to talk about the risks posed by the Delta variant now with Andy Slavitt. He's an expert on the virus. Until last month, he served as the senior advisor for the COVID-19 response in the Biden White House. And before that, he worked on getting PPE to the states and trying to influence the Trump White House to take the pandemic more seriously. He chronicled his efforts in nightly tweet storms and on his podcast, In the Bubble. Now he has a new book about the pandemic. It's called Preventable, the inside story of how leadership failures, politics, and selfishness doomed the U.S. coronavirus response. And Andy Slavitt joins me now. Welcome.
It's so good to be here.
It's so good to have you. Well, let's begin with the latest news about the virus. And the latest news involves the Delta variant. It is now the dominant variant here in California. Are you worried about it? And are you worried about it at all for vaccinated people?
Well, you asked the key question. I am indeed worried about it for people around the globe who haven't been vaccinated. And of course, people here in California and throughout the country who've chosen not to be vaccinated, because this really is 2020 COVID on steroids. It's twice as easy to catch. But for people who are vaccinated, while I understand their precaution at the news and the uncertainty, the vaccines are very, very effective, particularly against getting sick. And so there's nothing that's really shaken my confidence in that. But, you know, people have different comfort levels. And, you know, some may choose to take additional precautions, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Well, as you probably know, in LA County, the public health department has recommended that people who are vaccinated still mask when going indoors in public places, like the grocery store, for example. That's not what the CDC recommends. Where do you fall on that?
Well, look, there's the science and then there's the human psychology. So the science would say that the CDC is right, that your chances of going into a grocery store or a restaurant without a mask if you're fully vaccinated is very, very low. But there are other things at play, which may cause you to want to wear a mask or what may cause LA County to change that recommendation. You know, one is just this sort of spirit of looking out for others and giving people comfort. You know, another is just this feeling that, you know, we've all been through quite an ordeal over the last year, and we may want to choose to be a little more careful than even the science indicates. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing that says we have to follow the science to a T. But for those who choose to not wear a mask, I think they're justified in doing so. Those who do want to wear a mask, I think they're justified in doing so. And, you know, I think it's, you know, I interpret the LA County suggestion as a suggestion, nothing more forceful, but I think that carries some weight because, you know, these are things that the health commissioner certainly spends a lot of time thinking about how to do and how to do right.
Right. And I guess there's a different question in terms of, are you yourself at risk, or are you responsible to try to prevent it in other people? And the World Health Organization hasn't said definitively whether or not this Delta variant is more easily transmissible from fully vaccinated people. So when we have only half of the population fully vaccinated here in LA, putting on a mask in a public place may be more about preventing an infection for people who aren't vaccinated.
Well, you know, nothing's guaranteed, right? So if you've got a vaccine that's 90% effective, and we know that, in fact, many people get COVID and are asymptomatic, and if you're asymptomatic, the odds are very good that your viral load is pretty low. But of course, it's entirely possible that you could get the virus, be asymptomatic, and spread it. You know, it's unlikely in the chain of events. You know, we don't see a lot of cases of that. But look, we're not talking about playing the odds here. We're talking about making, you know, decisions that we think are right for ourselves, for our family, and for the community. And so, again, while I think the CDC is scientifically correct, I only think that's one bit of guidance, and we should use other thinking if it helps us to get through. But I certainly don't walk into a room with people who are unmasked now and feel unsafe.
Is there any place where you do put your mask on that's not mandated?
Well, I do put my mask on when I travel, in large part because it's required, but also because I think there's something to be said for doing what's customary and keeps people feeling safer. And of course, when you're traveling, you don't know, there's a little more uncertainty because people are coming from all over the place and may in fact be carrying different variants with them. And I suppose if I was in a community that had high levels of COVID right now or low levels of vaccination, I might be more inclined to put on a mask, although I would tell you that even without the mask, I would feel pretty safe.
So you'd go inside and eat in a restaurant, go to a movie theater, go to a grocery store, and not worry about a mask?
Yeah, that's right. You know, we have these amazing vaccines. Their record is incredible. 99.2% of the people that have died from COVID recently have all been unvaccinated. It is very unlikely at this point in time that if you're vaccinated, that you're at serious risk. Now, it does happen. You know, it will happen. That's not unheard of. But most of those cases are going to be very, very mild. Some people may choose to protect themselves against those mild cases for good reason. You know, I have a son who experiencing COVID symptoms 6 months after getting COVID. He's 19 years old. And, you know, I don't wish that fate on people. Now, that was before he had a chance to get vaccinated. But certainly it is reasonable for people who say, you know what, I don't want to even entertain the possibility of getting COVID and the chance that it sticks with me like it did with my son, for them to put on a mask. So, you know, I think people's choices really reflect the level of risk that they feel comfortable with.
How is your son doing? What kinds of symptoms is he still experiencing?
Well, you know, a strange set of symptoms. They sort of come and go, and they're by no means debilitating. He has cold extremities. His fingers and are often turn purple and get quite cold. He's had, you know, on and off shortness of breath, tachycardia, rapid heart rate, occasional colds. So nothing too severe, but all things that have started, after he got COVID. And, you know, for us as parents, we're a little bit uncertain as to how long this lasts.
Right. And it's lasted for 6 months?
I said about 6 months.
That's concerning.
Right. And, you know, as a parent, you know, your go-to move with your kids is, Dad, how long is this going to last, or am I going to be okay? And you like to have an answer for your kid. I mean, that sort of feels like part of your job as a parent. So it's a strange situation because it's a new world and, you know, we don't really know. So he's too smart for me to bluff him.
Well, yeah, I mean, and if you don't know, who's going to know? Because you are in contact with all of the experts and, well, you wrote a book about it, which I guess is also reassuring, and it's not reassuring because we look to experts to help us make these decisions. And when there isn't a lot of information, even for people like you, what are we supposed to be doing? Because there's so much contradicting information out there. Like I just mentioned, there's contradicting advice from the CDC and the LA Department of Public Health. So what's your advice to just the regular folk like us,
right,
about trying to follow the correct advice? Like, where should we look?
Right. Well, look, we've all been through a lot, and it's important that we recognize that the last year has been a traumatic experience for nearly everyone. Everyone suffered in different ways, but I don't know anybody who hasn't, you know, suffered at all, and that's going to linger. You know, my advice is easy for people who haven't been vaccinated. Just to strongly, strongly, strongly consider getting vaccinated. Get your questions answered if you haven't. Talk to your physician, because it's a world of difference. You know, if you have been vaccinated, you know, my advice is that you can continue to pay attention and continue to take precautions. But it's also, I think, very important for people to start to get back the parts of their lives they felt like they lost over the last year, reconnecting with people who you've lost touch with, getting together with people physically. The risks are very, very, very low. And so, you know, we are moving from a place where COVID overwhelmed our lives and was kind of DEFCON 5 emergency to a place that I would call COVID now a manageable challenge. And look, Madeline, we have a lot of manageable challenges in our life. Mm-hmm. The traffic in LA is a manageable challenge. It doesn't stop us from going from A to B.
I'm not so sure about that.
Okay, bad example. But you know, there are things that come up in life all the time, and we have the tools to get through them. And, you know, COVID-19, I think, is, you know, joining the long list of things that isn't disappeared from our lives, but it's something that we are perfectly capable of not having overwhelm us. You know, we're just not in a situation today where we are, again, if we've been vaccinated, at such great risk that we need to be constantly worrying.
Let's talk about your book now. And it really is a play-by-play of how the U.S., the federal government, mishandled this, grossly mishandled it, and could have avoided a lot of deaths. At one point, you say, we could have tamed this in 6 weeks. How would that have happened?
Well, you know, there's something about the way the rest of the world was able to handle COVID-19 that was resulted in far fewer people dying. If we would have, you know, had a response resembling, say, Germany, which was not the best and not the worst, and has a lot in common with us, you know, we could have presented 2/3 to 3/4 of the deaths that we did here. I don't think it's possible to have a perfect response, but we certainly know how COVID spreads. And, you know, I think one of the things that I think the book observes, in addition to all of the political things and everything else, is that in order to do that, we really rely upon one another to keep each other safe. And in other societies that have both, I think, a little more of an egalitarian mindset, perhaps, and also places that have more familiarity with public health emergencies, they were able to really do a much better job shutting down the virus by simply making sure not to gather in large crowds, to wear masks. And, you know, large portions of our country just felt it wasn't worthwhile to do that. And in some part, it's because we have such a split, such a divide between how the people who are most at risk live and people who are at very low risk live.
Right. You call it the room service pandemic.
Exactly. I mean, it's exactly right. I mean, here in Los Angeles and the outlying areas, we have, you know, populations where people live very close quarters. They work hourly jobs. They're exposed to the public all day long. And they're often black and brown communities with more challenging access to healthcare to begin with. And then we have people who live on that other side of that of the room service wall who are getting, you know, we're able to get packages at home and watch Netflix and stay relatively safe and spread out in their homes. And, you know, I think there wasn't as always a high consciousness for what one side felt like and what the other side felt like. And that's as much a reflection on our society that it is anything particular about the pandemic itself.
And that really crosses political lines, because there are people receiving room service, as you call it, you know, the people who are able to work from home and get all their stuff delivered, you know, on all sides of the political aisle.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, this is kind of how we, you know, as a society have evolved. And I think, you know, the pandemic was interesting. And I think one of the notes in the book is it reflects on a lot of the things that we take for granted as being good ideas until they come under stress. You know, this notion of unfettered capitalism, the idea that we can all challenge experts at will and put our own knowledge up against any expert's knowledge, and that everybody's opinion is equal. And, you know, the great inequality and race divisions that have occurred in the country over the last couple of decades, all of those things are things we've known about. But in a pandemic, they were some of the things that really drove a lot more deaths. Again, putting aside the Trump White House, which, you know, I've got a fair amount to say about that as well, those factors would have been here anyway.
Right. Well, let's talk about the Trump White House. And, of course, we all remember how Trump wanted to downplay the virus up till the very end, actually, even after he got it himself. But at the beginning, he was insistent that he could reopen the economy by Easter of 2020. And I just want to play a clip of him on Fox on March 24th, 2020, during a coronavirus virtual town hall, talking about that.
We're opening up this incredible country because we have to do that. I'd love to have it open by Easter. Okay, I would to have it open by Easter. I will tell you that right now. I would love to have that. It's such an important day for other reasons, but I'll make it an important day for this too. I would love to have the country opened up and just raring to go by Easter.
That's April 12th. So we will watch and see what happens. I'm going to toss it back to my cohort.
Okay, so even the Fox News personality there was a little bit incredulous. And I just played that because some of your earliest conversations with Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, and one of his top advisors at the time, involved trying to convince him that this Easter reopening was a terrible idea. What did you say to Jared Kushner about that?
Well, you know, Jared said to me he wanted the president to get credit for opening the economy and that inevitably, as things turned bad again, he would push it onto the states to get blame. So from their standpoint, the calculation wasn't so much about human life as it was about how to avoid accountability. So I called Jared. I didn't know Jared, but we knew of each other through mutual friends, and told him that I thought it was a mistake and it was something that we could avoid. And I offered to put together some information that he would put in front of the president to help persuade the president to push the date back. Ultimately, we did put something together with the help of a number of scientists. Jared did put it in front of the president, and the president ultimately delayed. But sadly, he only delayed until the end of April. And come end of April, they did effectuate their strategy, which they called the state authority handoff, which they believed would allow them to escape accountability when things inevitably went wrong. And I'm not so sure that that ended up working out for them.
Right. So it was basically an abdication in your eyes of the federal government's role and responsibility. And was that basically so that Trump could avoid any blame should it go south? I mean, and given Bob Woodward's book and the revelations that he was already well aware of what the projections were, he was aware that there would be a lot of deaths.
You know, pandemics are hard without pathological leadership. You know, I'm pretty forgiving, and I think we all are pretty forgiving of honest mistakes from leaders who are trying their best to save as many lives as possible. We know that in the fog of war, there's no easy solutions. So if the president had simply said early on when he was aware in January, hey, we have a problem, we should all prepare ourselves and protect ourselves until such time as we have a solution, that alone would have saved hundreds of thousands of lives. And so there are parts in the book when, you know, it is clear that he's doing everything he can, not just to deny the existence of the virus, which we all saw, but every time there was any amount of dissenting voice within the scientific community, anytime there was someone in the cabinet who raised their hand and said, hey, wait a minute, we might want to warn the public, he either fired them or silenced them. There was a moment when Alex Azar, who by and large was following his orders, simply wanted to add the phrase, but things might change rapidly, to an otherwise very sunny report. He was going to do that on Fox and Friends. When the White House communications team saw that, she pulled him from Fox and Friends and forbade the Department of Health and Human Services from talking to the public or the press for 45 days. So imagine this, Madeline. We have a global pandemic, and our own Department of Health and Human Services isn't allowed to even communicate with us because they were saying something other than the narrative that the president wanted, which is that this whole thing is overblown and it's going to end quickly.
Well, Alex Azar was confident he could stand up to Trump. He said, he knows I'm of strong will, saying that he would tell him the truth. And he didn't.
I kind of let that phrase stand on its own because he had asked me to help support him when he was going in front of the Senate to be confirmed as the Health and Human Services Secretary. And I said, Alex, the one thing that I have to ask you is when you're in the room with the president and he tries to bully you or says something that's abjectly stupid, will you have the guts to stand up to him? That was my only question for him. And he assured me that he was a strong person and of strong will and would do that. And sadly, he carried out many orders that he knew better than to carry out.
What about Deborah Birx? Because she also had a sterling reputation before she ended up being his top advisor and being on the coronavirus task force for a while until she, too, was booted off and banned from going on TV. But why did she stick with Trump? I mean, there was that famous press conference where he talked about injecting bleach and she just kind of sat there and didn't say anything. That earned her a lot of enmity from people who were just shocked that he was saying that on national television.
Yeah, I mean, Deborah Birx managed to anger pretty much all sides of the equation. But I will say this, I spent a fair amount of time with Deborah Birx, and the book to some degree chronicles her kind of movements in and out of various states of mind from massively supportive to skeptical to angry to feeling betrayed to feeling used. And all I can say is for anybody who doesn't like Deborah Birx, they hadn't had the pleasure yet of meeting Scott Atlas.
The man who replaced her, who?
The man who replaced her, who was really not so much of a man who replaced her as he was a Frankenstein monster that filled an opinion that Trump wanted someone to have. And in fact, I heard this directly from Reince Priebus, the former chief of staff, who said that the Trump administration was going to play on the media's penchant for both sidesism and go find its own expert with a Stanford, Harvard, or Yale credential who would say that what the president was saying is right and that what all the other scientists were saying was wrong. And it took him several months, but they found Scott Atlas, and he pretty much was just somebody who was willing to say what Trump wanted him to say, which is that everything's overblown and we need to stop paying attention to the virus.
Well, does Deborah Birx regret not standing up to him more publicly and earlier?
I think Deborah Birx probably in some part feels like she did the best she could because, I think she realized she was working for someone who was not paying attention to the science. And I'm sure she felt like she was working the refs and striking a bargain, and that people tell themselves in those situations that if they leave, things will be worse than if they stay. And whether that's true or not, I think Deborah Birx had appropriate intentions. She certainly wanted to put the pandemic to an end. But to some extent, once she made the decision to continue working for Trump, she really became a reflection of that. And she had no real ability to any longer have an independent voice. So I think the only decision that she could have made was to leave earlier than she did. And I think she probably thought about it continuously and probably thought that she was in a better position to help by staying. And whether or not she's just telling herself that or whether or not that's a reality is something that people can decide for themselves.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Andy Slavitt. He's former senior advisor for the COVID-19 response in the Biden White House, and his new book is called Preventable, The Inside Story of How Leadership Failures, Politics, and Selfishness Doomed the U.S. Coronavirus Response. One of the huge missteps was, of course, not having enough PPE for healthcare workers and also for the American public. You started a nonprofit called Project N95 to find masks for healthcare workers. And there is a scene in your book where you call up 3M, who makes these N95 masks. And I just want you to recount the conversation you had with 3M and you trying to convince them to get a handle on not only making more masks, but distributing them to the places where they're needed most. And can you talk about that conversation?
Sure. I think we were all under the impression that everybody was doing everything they could and that everybody was watching all of these nurses die and so that there must be no more masks. Yet all of these masks that were made by 3M, something just didn't compute for me, which was that on a regular basis, I would get emails, I'm sure many people did as well, offering to sell me a million N95 masks at some outrageous price. And people were black marketing their product. And so I figured, well, gee, there must be an abundance of these masks somewhere by people who are getting them and not using them. So I called 3M and said exactly that. Are you sending masks to countries that are already have an overabundance of masks? And even further, are you selling masks to places that are not hospitals, to painters, to contractors? And their response was incredibly disappointing. They said, it's not our job to track where our masks go, and we're doing all we can. And I said, gee, that feels like there are millions and millions of masks out there that if you took control, you could get those to hospitals and nurses, and we could start saving more people's lives. And when they were reluctant, I did something that I never thought I would do, which is I told them that if they didn't make a change, that the president of the United States was likely to tweet about what they were doing. And that got their attention. And when it got their attention, I called the White House and actually talked to a staffer who persuaded the president to do exactly that. And the president tweeted about 3M's behavior. And days later, they announced hundreds of millions of masks that had been going overseas were going to be sent into the U.S. And Trump was hailed as a brilliant deal maker and 3M as a patriotic company. And my wife and I just laughed and had a drink.
Wow. Did you ever get in the room with Trump and talk to him about this? Were you able to do that?
No, I didn't. You know, I talked to Jared, which about is as close as, you know, you could come. And at some points that was effective. At some points that was ineffective. But I spend most of my time with other people in the White House on the scientific side, and then many, many governors. Because once the president decided to thrust responsibility onto them, most states did not have the resources or the know-how to begin to figure out what to do.
What is your conclusion when it comes to the motivations on the part of the Trump administration? Why were they seemingly okay with letting this virus take its course and be out of control and kill so many people? They must have had the projections. So what was their overall philosophy, from as best you can tell?
I think we had a rare combination of things. He had a set of advisors that their voices were silenced. So I think he heard nothing but agreement from people. And Trump's basic flaw, and we, you know, I think we know this isn't any great insight, is that he sees himself in everything. And once he saw COVID-19 as a reflection on him and his presidency, it became very difficult for him to do anything other than continue to downplay and deny that this was going on. And I think he thought his strategy of saying that this isn't my fault and I could point fingers other places, and, you know, he has an historic ability to change the narrative by saying what he thinks his supporters will believe. And he believed that if the stock market went up and he could do those things, I think he believed that he would ultimately be successful. Now, it turned out not to be the case. The conventional wisdom in these situations is that actually it's the leader who stands up and says, we're in trouble, it's time to sacrifice, let's pull together, that ends up getting more support. But I think ultimately he wasn't capable. You know, I think he, like many other populist leaders around the world, believed that things wouldn't stick with him. If he said popular things and if he continued to rally his crowd, that would ultimately work out for him, and it didn't.
And it didn't work out for the country and for the 600,000 or so people who died.
Sadly, yes, that's right.
How do you view the current administration? I know you worked briefly for them on this issue. President Biden did set a goal of 70% of the country getting their first shot by July 4th, and that didn't happen. Is that the fault of the administration? Is it the fault of vaccine deniers or of us or a combination of a lot of different things?
Well, look, the lens I have, and it's to put ourselves back in the shoes we were when I showed up in Washington on January 20th. 2% of the adult population had been vaccinated. There was no vaccine inventory. There were not enough vaccinators. There weren't enough vaccination sites. Only 40% of people even said they would get vaccinated if they got a shot. And we hadn't purchased enough vaccines. And yet the president took full accountability and basically made the decision that he was not going to get distracted by fights with governors or excuses, or even the weather. If you recall, we had a weather event which disrupted things, but that we were going to take accountability for vaccinating the country as quickly as possible. So to sit here now, 6 months later, with, you know, still over 67% of adults fully vaccinated, everybody who wanted a shot was able to get one, not by the end of the year as what was originally projected, but by April or May, and people to be able to gather safely again, is quite an accomplishment. And when the president set the goal for 4th of July, his original goal, if you recall, was that people would be able to gather in small groups outdoors without masks by 4th of July. And at the time, people were quite skeptical, understandably so, because we had raging variants, high case counts, low vaccine confidence, and we're very, very far from where we are right now. And so, I think we've witnessed, as a country, probably the largest transformation in 6 months' time of the health and well-being of a nation. And I think the president really led the country through that. You know, my experience with him, which I write about a little bit in the book, is he did this because he almost had the opposite approach of President Trump. One of the things that he said to me was, Andy, don't worry about making me look good. Give people the information they need to help them. Those are much easier marching orders to follow than the people who worked for President Trump had. We just basically had to go out and do our jobs. It wasn't necessarily an easy job, but it was a job that we knew we had the president's full support for.
But that a significant portion of the country is not vaccinated and doesn't plan to get vaccinated or doesn't want to right now. How do you address that? And is that a surprise to you that here we do have all these incredibly effective, plentiful vaccines? They're free, they're everywhere. And so many people aren't getting vaccinated.
Well, I think the data would suggest that by and large, there's two types of people that haven't gotten vaccinated at this point. And one of them are people to whom they're just basically complacent. This is a low priority. They don't feel very much at risk. Generally speaking, those are people who are under 25. More than 70% of people over 25 have now been vaccinated. Look, and I say this with love and affection for my 23-year-old and my 19-year-old, but they have other priorities. They don't feel particularly at risk. My kids are both vaccinated, for the record, but I understand why, you know, when you're 23, this doesn't feel as important. And, you know, we've got to continue to get the message to younger people that this does matter. But be sure, you know, they have all of their other vaccines. They're not anti-vaccine. They're just not prioritizing this. And the second group of people are people to whom this is just frankly a much more considered decision. They have open questions that they want answered. They want to understand the long-term side effects. They want to understand whether this might impact their fertility. They've got questions that can only be described as reasonable. And, you know, we make a mistake if we ostracize them and sort of consider them to be anti-vax. We're better off kind of respecting the fact that they've got a process to go through. You know, my process was a quick process to make a decision to get a vaccine. Yours may have been quick, it may have been slow, you may have had reservations, but I think we're only going to be successful if we don't take the tact of trying to persuade people why they're stupid, but instead give them the information they need so that they can make that decision. And I suspect over time, even if it happens more slowly, many of those people will come on board and get vaccinated over time. The sooner the better, but, you know, ultimately in this country, it's up to them.
Do you think when you're looking back on this past, you know, 15 months or so, when you were fully immersed in this, what was the biggest mistake that you made when you were going about trying to help stem this pandemic?
Oh, I think the thing I misjudged was I really thought, and it sounds so naive to say it now, that this pandemic would act to bring the country together and that we would support one another. And, you know, these moments that we saw fleeting glimpses of where people were sewing masks for workers and celebrating doctors and nurses, that there would be an opportunity for this to rally us and that this would be a hard challenge. But much like other challenges like the Depression and World War II, we would be able to come through it stronger. And I really thought that's where we were headed. And unfortunately, while we had some of those moments, we sort of fell apart. And I didn't count on many of the social dynamics that came to being. And I didn't count on masks being politicized and this being used for advantage by politicians. And that was really disappointing.
And I guess that's almost more difficult to try to fix, is because it's something that it's not fixed with a vaccine or a mask. This is what you're talking about is like just the very essence of our country right now, this fraying of the social fabric and the fact that we live in these isolated communities that don't seem to want to even talk to each other anymore.
Well, that's right. You know, I commonly get asked the question, what do we do to prevent the next pandemic? And, you know, I have a more immediate question. What do we do about the things we learned during this pandemic that we could fix? So we learned during this pandemic that there are a lot of kids that go to school every day, and if they don't go to school, they don't get lunch because they can't afford lunch at home, and that there's many kids that don't have internet at home, and so they can't study. Well, those things were true before the pandemic, and they were true during the pandemic, and maybe they came into view of a lot of people during the pandemic. But it's really up to us as to whether they're going to be true after the pandemic. And if we don't tend to those sorts of issues, then I have very low expectations about our ability to deal with another public health crisis. Said another way, if we do invest in the things that will make us a better society, I think it gives me a lot more confidence, back to the earlier part of our conversation, that we will be able to support one another and deal with crises like this again better.
I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, it was such a pleasure.
It's Andy Slavitt. His new book is called Preventable, the inside story of how leadership failures, politics, and selfishness doomed the U.S. coronavirus response. Our producers are Rosalie Atkinson, Angie Perrin, Bennett Purser, Nihar Patel, and Kaylee Wells. Brian Hardzinski was our line editor this week. Amy Ta, our digital editor. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. Our technical directors are Mario Saavedra and Phil Richards. Thanks for listening to Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you on Monday.